Philosophy 10, May 16th, 1949.
You could pass because what has happened during the last 400 years, gentlemen, is right here in the organization of this college and is quite well known to you. The coming into existence of laboratories, we said, that is the main result of the academic world. That was point one. Externally today, any school is a school of natural which is in touch with the natural sciences if it contains and while it contains and because it contains a laboratory. And we saw, gentlemen, that the thing has come from the secret laboratory of men like Paracelsus, who just used the blacksmithy for his experiments. It has come down to every man having his own little lab in the cellar of his house and blowing his own house up. Today, laboratories are commonplace. I wish today to implement a little bit the story of the coming of the laboratory by telling you that Vesalius, the great anatomist, who was the physician of the Emperor Charles V, when he drew his famous beautiful drawings of the anatomy of the human body in the 30s of the 16th century, I think the first edition was 1539, that he had to do this with torchlight at night in the basement of the palace of the emperor. The emperor was all for it, but the clergymen were not so much for it. The emperor, by the way, a Roman Catholic emperor, Charles V, was a great friend of the new sciences. And you must not think, gentlemen, that in the 16th century there was any better supporter of modern science than Catholics. The Protestants were all against natural science. They wanted to save the world by better religion. The Catholics had not much to offer in the form of better religion, you see. So they thought they could save the world by better science. It takes us down, gentlemen, from 1500 to 1650. The favors and sponsors of science in the modern sense were throughout Catholics and not Protestants. The Protestant princes were much more hostile to modern science than the Catholics. Charles V, for example, had the famous book of Copernicus on the revolutions of the stars, in which he proclaimed the new idea of the solar system. He had it sent to him right away from the publisher as the newest publication, you see. So eager was the emperor, who fought Luther tooth and nail at the same time to propagate the new natural science. So please, will you kindly cure yourself of the idea that from the very beginning, natural science and Catholic Church are the antagonists. From 1450, you may say, from the Florentine Academy in honor of Plato's memory, down to 1650, the Catholics were favorable to the new science and the Protestants were very unfavorable, because Protestantism meant once more an attempt to go forward on the path of religion. And as I said, the Catholics had at that time only the idea in religion that everything was as it should be, and therefore had to open up new avenues. For example, gentlemen, the Jesuits were the first school teachers in Europe to introduce the new sciences into their teaching. In the Jesuit schools from 1540, when the order was founded, to 1640, there was better instruction in the natural sciences than in any other school in Europe. Because again, the Protestant schools wanted people to read the Bible in Greek and in Hebrew. That was their interest, you see. The Catholics wanted to take their mind into the miracles of the wide world, and therefore taught mathematics and botany and chemistry not long before it was ever taught in a Protestant school. All this is unknown to you because you all live through the glasses of the French Revolution of 1789. And these are very short-sighted glasses, gentlemen. Everything that was true in 1789 you believe as gospel to this day. But what was true in 1789 wasn't even true in 1640. And it isn't true today. Today and in 1640, gentlemen, the fronts are not science and Catholic Church. But they were in 1789. And this casual front you have to tear down, because that's just a temporary idea. Therefore, you see, what I'm trying to do today is to introduce you into the fronts of the natural science to the previously existing world. We have seen the medieval cycle, and I now have tried to show you how the academic sciences stand within your and our community. You know very well that at this moment there are only two official pillars of day and night, communism and the Catholic Church. Now that's a very strange arrangement. In this very moment you see suddenly all scientists taking refuge behind the skirts of the church, clergy. I mean, two of the atomic scientists, when they discovered what they had done, became monks. Well, they may. That is, they went backward, gentlemen. You can very simply say, this is 1500, this is 1100, then we have this period 1500 to today. And today the question is, do we go forward into a third phase, or do we go backward? Now, the atomic scientists, most of them, try to make their peace with the medieval period. There's a tremendous nostalgia today, as you know, for going Catholic, for reading Thomas Aquinas, as they do in Chicago. These are all attempts to go backward into the scholastic cycle and to escape from the dire consequences, gentlemen, of the commonplace situation of the natural sciences. And this has to do with the enmity into which the humanism of the natural sciences from 1789 to this day has brought itself against everything itself. You see the crime of the humanistic cycle in which you move, or of liberalism, is that they have considered themselves the crown of creation and not, denied everything else. They have denied that the sciences are a fruit of Christianity. They have denied that the natural sciences were only possible after the Middle Ages. They have said the Middle Ages were dark. They have said that there were no universities before themselves, the academic sciences. They have denied their own tree out of which they have grown. And therefore, a liberal today is the most unhappy creature in the world. He has a background of only 100 years, and that's too short for any mind to be healthy. And they are completely cut off from the roots of our civilization, and therefore they have no hope to go on. You cannot be in 1980 a liberal. That's just obsolete. Because you have cut your roots in the sense in which liberalism is used, at least in this country, gentlemen, which go back before the French Revolution. Liberalism, gentlemen, in this country means that a liberal can be without the conservative. Now, that's important. There was a man in Boston who was famous as an atheist and freethinker. And one day, a friend of mine, who is a congregational minister, received the visit of this gentleman with his son. Would you kindly take my son and give him religious instruction? And the minister was taken aback and said, but sir, is this a joke? You have attacked us left and right. What's the matter? He said, no, believe me, I've come to understand that you have to have something to liberalize upon. I want to give my son now a conservative education so that later he can be progress from there and liberalize upon it. That's a tragedy of the modern liberal as you find them today. Now they don't know what to do. They will try to send their children to Sunday school. You can't do this if you're going to go to church yourself. It's ridiculous. It's insincere. All of a sudden, all the liberals in this country who think that the Pope is a nice man, at least a nicer man than Mr. Stalin, no, I don't know. All the people, the liberals, think they must side with Mr. Stalin. So they have lost either the future or the past. Because the future is a yawning abyss of all their freedoms. I mean, all the fellow travelers here. And for the last 20 years, you can take this down, really. For the last 20 years, the American liberals had actually thought that the choice was, if they went forward, only between Stalin and Trotsky. That is, they had two tyrannical ideas. I can really bear the witness to this gentleman. I have been persecuted by these people and still are, because they cannot understand a man who has never been tempted either by Mr. Stalin or by Mr. Trotsky. I'm not interested in either one of them. And I think I'm going forward. But as a liberal in this country, the choices between going Catholic, like Mr. Hutchins in Chicago, at least in a formal sense, by teaching everybody Thomas Aquinas, or, as the intellectuals in New York, by being left, or pink, or fellow traveler, or something like this. Why? Because in this country, gentlemen, the mind has been merely imitating Europe. And now the first time the wind is blowing from Mr. Hitler and Mr. Stalin, so there was never any question in anybody's mind that this was the wave of the future. You may know that Mrs. Lindbergh, the wife of the famous flyer, wrote this fantastic book, The Wave of the Future, in which she sided with Hitler and said that's irresistible. That was in the 30s. Have you still heard of this book? It's very, very important to know, because now 10 years later, her husband has cautiously come out with a statement that he's back to Christianity. So they balance each other, which is good for flying. And so, gentlemen, this is all practical stuff. You have to know that the mind has moved from 1500 to 1900 to giving everybody his laboratory. And this practically means that today most people consider even marriage and war as experiments. Because to have a laboratory means to consider everything as experimental. We have an experimental theater, we have an experimental war, we have an the First World War was just an experiment. Then we went home and said, it didn't come off nicely, won't do it again. So the Second World War comes, that was very serious. Much more serious than the first. People in this country live by experiment, gentlemen. That is, the method of the natural science has today become commonplace. Whenever anything has become commonplace, gentlemen, it has lost all value for the renovation of human life. It is like with a pendulum that has run down in a clock, you have to wind it up again. Commonplace has no slow. If anything is commonplace, it means that you can't move anybody to extraordinary efforts to do it, because that what is commonplace can be done by anybody in his leisure time as an avocation or can. We saw, gentlemen, that the difference between idea and commonplace is very small and very decisive. If the thing is your dominating idea, you give your whole life. If it is your scientific purpose, you give your career, your profession, you see. If it is your education, you give some years. And if it's your commonplace, you give an hour a day. So you can, we learn that to commonplace is simply a question of no longer investing anything serious into something. If you aren't serious today in war or in marriage, so you get a divorce. If you want to be married really, gentlemen, it must be an infinite effort. To make, however, marriage commonplace, under psychological supervision and statistical kinsey report, must make it abortive, because, gentlemen, nothing what we planned as a finite effort can ever prevail on our own life. If you say to be married costs me $2 a day and 2 hours at night, that's nothing. That's prostitution. Because it is below your human standards. Gentlemen, nothing in life can be achieved without infinite devotion. The result is always finite. That the investment must be infinite. Or to put it in other way, gentlemen, if you wish to build up the new sciences and the house for the social sciences, we will have to make an infinite effort for finite results. Faith, love, and hope, gentlemen, are all dead and killed at the very moment that you measure them, that you say it's a commensurate effort. I'll put in 3 days or 3 hours of practice every day, then I become a great violinist. You will. It must first use you day and night. You never can tell if you have real faith in your career as a violinist. We have to see. They have to go to a Cape Town because they have the best violinist in space. And you may have to. But that's how people have reformed and re-educated Europe too during the last 5 years or 4 years, you see. By trips, by airplane. No infinite effort. Always knowing ahead of time when the return ticket was due. Will you kindly take this down, gentlemen, that among human beings or in any act of newness, nothing can ever be achieved without an infinite investment. Because the three powers, gentlemen, by which we create love, faith, and hope, die when they are treated as parts of space and time. Love, faith, and hope are the creators of new spaces and new times. And therefore, since they are creative forces, they are absolutely out. They are murdered. The very minute you say to somebody, I have faith to the extent of $5,000, or I have time to the extent of 3 hours, 20 minutes, or reading time, 9 seconds and a half, for an article in Liberty. This reading time shows you to what end the world has come. That's one of the most fantastic ideas. How can anybody know how long he should read something? That's his read of 10 times. And we developed today out of slow readers who have the chance of understanding what they read, fast readers, out of lip readers, which is the normal way of saying, eye readers, as you know. That is, we destroy the last remnants of the group that might understand something of the intellect. That's done here, and it's done everywhere in America, and people even are proud of this destruction of the human intellect. Because, gentlemen, if you go at something, the chances, if it is difficult, you will settle down and say, I have to work as hard as until I have gotten it. But if they tell you beforehand it's easy, it only takes an hour, you probably will never learn it. Because it is strange enough, but it is simply take it down, gentlemen, it is a condition of the higher life of the human species. Anything creative can only be received by an infinite effort. It's like infinity in mathematics. Nobody can understand calculus if he doesn't understand what infinity is. And you cannot gain any access to the secrets of the universe if you have not the notion of infinity. Now the same is true about your own effort. And therefore, gentlemen, anything, why do I say this? At this moment, infinity is abolished officially in a commonplace civilization. Anybody who says this takes infinite effort is laughed at and ridiculed and says, well, if you don't tell me how much it costs and how many people are going to buy it, and then it's nothing. Mr. Firestone, great patriot, is willing to pay any amount of million of dollars to spread
good things, Christianity and rubber tires, in this moment in this country.
And but one condition is attached. It must go over the radio. Now, gentlemen, nothing that begins can ever start with Mars programs. The Mars is always the last. So Mr. Firestone will waste millions on some hipsters, but nothing will happen.
Except that perhaps Firestone will sell more rubber tires. That may be.
But he's quite honest. He doesn't want to sell more rubber tires. He has sold too many. The income tax, you see, has to be beaten, so he wants to spend it. But the idea that you have to spend something valuable in such a manner that it lives on the fourth level of commonplace just means, you see, that over the radio everybody can get it without effort. If he can get it without effort, it can't be a fool. It's impossible, you see, because he neither gives time, nor seriousness, nor devotion, nor the fear of the Lord, nor anything, you see. He doesn't defy anybody by listening to Mr. Firestone. Now, if a man has no relation of infinite value to something new, it cannot come into existence. It cannot. This is the first thing, gentlemen, you have to know, because this is the condition for the giving birth to the social sciences which we really need if you don't want all to be destroyed and eaten up. That you cannot, buying from us on science, mathematics for the millions. That's a commonplace quote. But if somebody comes to you and says, listen, I should tell you something privately, but it's very dangerous here. The FBI will be after us. And nobody with their appearance won't like it. And the college will separate you. Then it's perhaps worthwhile listening. I don't know. It isn't doomed because something is secret or beginning or dangerous that it is good. But I would say, gentlemen, if anything is good, it must be dangerous. There is nothing without risk in this world, and you know it. And nobody tells you these things. So we have to be, gentlemen, the commonplace situation and the laboratory, I want to tell you, today is such commonplace that we have to tear out of the hands of this natural scientific method of commonplace all the things that are not experimental. Human society, gentlemen, consists of those processes which cannot be experimented with. That's human life and death, that's peace and war, that's marriage and having children, that's patriotism, that's truth, that's growth. I heard a terrible story about a young woman was ruined because the nurse was present at the delivery of their baby, and the doctor was later to become the obstetrician. It's such a gruesome story that I still can't, I can only tell it. I only was told it a few days ago. And this nurse, in her incapacity, was only conscious of the command, the doctor must be present at the delivery. So she pushed the baby back when it was out, and forced, therefore, the poor mother to contain the baby until the doctor was there. It was a real crime, and the mother has been invalidated and been an invalid also this event. There you see what limit, you see what lack of faith, love, and hope does to a nurse. She had only the technical routines, the doctor had to be present. So the child, the process of growth, met with no respect. But do you know that we do this in all our schools today, that we hold the children back and don't let them grow? And make them happy, and take away from them the feeling of importance and newness and expectation by intoxicating them with being nice to all other children. I know several children in Hanover who have been seriously ruined, and because they were kept back in their own home.
don't dance out of the outside, you see, outside, I mean, conform. The such word of conformity is a funnest, and conformity is constant growth. I mean, you take a lawnmower and you make the whole, all the grass even. You can level everything off. But I don't, wouldn't say that this is inducive to the growth of a special flower. I know this because with my lawnmower I went into the flower bed the other day at night, and my wife hasn't yet forgiven me. Growth, gentlemen, is something that commands respect and that cannot be experimented with. And all modern science in this country is a pseudoscience. It's just as funny as witch hunting in the 16th, 15th century, witch burning. But the natural sciences do today, they call themselves sociology and psychology, and they experiment with human beings. And therefore, they commit the crime of crimes, the crime against growth. Growth is something you cannot experiment with. You can only experiment, gentlemen, with dead things which are moved from the outside. Growth is the one process, gentlemen, where the movement is inside that which grows. You can test a man when he, for how long it takes him to fall down a scaffold, because that's only gravity, you see. He is not moved himself, his own mover. But where man is his own prime mover, you must never experiment with him. Now all living plants, animals, and men grow. And growth is a movement which has its center inside itself. Therefore, anything growing is inaccessible to the methods of the laboratory. And wherever a man wants to use microscopes and measurements for growth, try to have him executed. He's a murderer. And you must learn, gentlemen, that today there are more crimes committed against growth in the world than any crimes against the existence of life. Although we have concentration camps and we have brutality and we have wars, I think more souls today are crushed and prevented from growing than bodies are killed in all these terrible forces. Growth is more despised in an experimental society, you see, today than just human life. The disregard for growth is greater, I think, than the disregard for human life, even today, with all the many murders committed. Once your eyes are open to this, gentlemen, you will understand what the sin against the Holy Spirit means, which cannot be forgiven. It's exactly this. Which is committed today officially by every college and every institution in this country. Now, why do I say all these things, gentlemen? To show you that the laboratory of the last 400 years was at first called into being by heroic action by these great founders. As long as these founders were individuals, the Catholic Church, so perhaps impeding the individual founder because of his confusion, was still perfectly willing to find the miracles of God in the world. The Lutherans were not. Luther was against the worldly sciences. The Catholics were not. From 1650, gentlemen, to 1789, the academies were institutionalized, as you know. That is, they took up the research.
And here develops the antagonism between the church and the natural sciences, which you now think is hereditary. The reason was because these academies were indifferent to the denomination and religion of their members. Even to 1789, the Catholic Church was not hostile to research, but they couldn't stomach the toleration of scientists, you see, who were not Catholics. And so the funny thing is this, the first reason of the hostility of the Catholic Church to science is a sociological and not an intellectual reason. The mixing of Catholics and non-Catholics. What you see today, again, the church with their segregation, you see, you must have a Catholic tennis club and a Catholic fishmonger club, etc. It is this segregational aspect, gentlemen, that the heretic should not be socially met, which develops at first the hostility. I told you that in 1635, the great Cardinal Richelieu asked Protestants, Huguenots, to join his academy. He being half a politician of the state and half a member, only formally, a cardinal of the church, saw that the new science, the new approach, had to be carried out by everybody who could use his wits. That there was no reason why a non-Catholic should not be a member of the academy. But the Catholic Church, you see, deeply hurt by the religious wars of the previous century, decided to say that Catholics should not side and sit and eat and meet with Protestants. So, gentlemen, it's a sociological reason, the founding of these academies, which brought about the rift between Catholics and Protestants in matters of science. I think that's very important for you to know. With whom you are not on speaking terms, gentlemen, he becomes your enemy. And the Catholics from 1640 to 1789 tried to avoid, whenever they could for their faithful, the social amenities. You see the exchange. In no intermarriages they could have it, and no social intercourse. And the Royal Society, for example, in 1665, when it was founded, was a typical modern society in which neither could a member be asked what he believed or what the notion he was, nor could the word religion or God be mentioned in any one of its dealings, in its transactions. The Royal Society pushed the worldliness and the religious neutrality of the academic spirit to its limits. It went so far, gentlemen, that any systematic remark was excluded for the first 20 years of the transactions from the society. If you read the transactions of the Royal Society today, you think you are in a madhouse, because only empirical statements of fact were admitted. No order could be put into it. No general rules could be derived there. They were so anxious to live only with the reports, you see, as a search of facts from the world. And they hated all system, hated all order. Goethe, the German poet whose anniversary we celebrate this year, has written a very charming essay on the transactions of the British Royal Society, in which he says it's just unbelievable to what ultimate, really ridiculous atomism human intellect can go from fear of falling into the scholastic trap of system. And so, gentlemen, the rift between science and the church came from the new republic of scholars, from the new fellowship which the academies represented. A fellowship, you see, not dependent on religious fellowship. A weekday fellowship, so to speak, without regard to where you go to church on Sunday. And, gentlemen, human relations precede mental relations. If you break away from a fellow, Then you suspect what he thinks, because you don't meet him anymore. If you meet a man, he can have the most abstruse ideas.
You still can trust him, you see. You say he has very interesting ideas. I don't approve of them.
But if you don't meet a man, on principle, let's say, I'll never meet him, you see, then of course you begin to think that he has strange ideas, intolerable ideas.
I think it's a little bit the case with Russians at this moment. We have made up our mind that we won't mix with Russians, so we credit them with the most incredible ideas. And then we are very surprised when in a special case they are just normal and can fall in love with a woman, etc. From 1789, gentlemen, to 1914, or 19 to this day, it makes no difference whenever you date this, science and the Catholic Church carried the animosity further, because after 1789, the liberals held dogmatically that everything that was needed for the education of a human being was science. That they were self-supporting, that liberalism could pull itself out by its own bootstraps, and that science was a primary source of human illumination, of human enlightenment. From 1789, science became, in its own mind, sovereign. It denied the sequence of the first and the second intellectual cycle, which had never been done before. Only in 1789, gentlemen, did the academies enter the universities and say, your university training has to be changed. I told you that in Dartmouth, only in 1890 did this third period enter. If up to 1890, President Bartlett here would give a course to every senior in place of this GI course, the Universal History of Mankind, instead of, and that was a real introduction of every member of the class, of the senior class, to his place in the universe. Was an historical course, not a geographical or economic or political course. And the second thing was that down to 1890 there was no laboratory on this campus. The thing that came nearest to a laboratory was called the philosophical apparatus. You may take this down, gentlemen. That the medieval expression philosophical apparatus was still used for the globe and the few maps they had and the ruler and such things in this college down to 1890. Philosophical apparatus is a medieval expression, because philosophy is the wisdom of this world, of the natural world. And in comparison to the divine knowledge, you see, and the law, theology and law, the philosophical apparatus was just for the camp school, was just for the minor things of the world. So, gentlemen, can you find a technique in your notebook to make it clear that the word philosophical apparatus, although used in 1889, is still a medieval expression, something that has still hang on in this country from before 1500. Nobody in his 5 centuries could today call the map of the world philosophical apparatus, because the word philosophy has exploded in all the many natural sciences, you see. Before 1500, the word philosophy covered all that knowledge of nature, all knowledge of the world. Philosophy meant wisdom of this world. Theology meant wisdom of the other world. So in 1890, in this college, there was still the conflict between medieval nomenclature and modern nomenclature. Because there was philosophical apparatus, which was the only sense for monks and priests, you see, who had to know a little astronomy, but just on the side, it wasn't their real study, you see. It wasn't good enough for university, but was only good for, like, arithmetic, for preparing yourself, the real study. But then in 1890, the laboratory takes over, which means that it is for adults, that it is a real science, that it is something better than theology and law, more real science, more scientific. So, gentlemen, philosophical apparatus meant recognition, gentlemen, that philosophy is secondary to religion and law. Laboratory means that the form of scientific research dominates and that the research men can do without religion and law. And so, law. Now, there is state and church, and he is his own master, that he is himself the mastermind and the philosopher, he is the captain of his soul. This damned word, I'm the captain of my soul, which leads everybody in Waterbury, leads everybody to Waterbury or Bellevue. Nobody is a captain of his soul, gentlemen, or he has no soul. Soul is your part in God, and how can you be the captain of your soul, the one thing with which you are not yourself, but better than yourself? It's a fantastic notion. That's a typical 19th century notion of a liberal. This sentence, you are the captain, or I am the captain of my soul, what is it? You are the captain of your soul? He is the captain of his soul? What? Yes, yes. And then he gets married and all over. In this sentence, gentlemen, you can recognize the arrogance of the liberal of the 19th century. I am the captain of my soul. You can be a captain of a ship, you can be a captain of a thing, you see, which you direct by your mind. But if the soul is anything, it is your captain. If there is a hell, if the man has a soul, then certainly nothing else is your captain but your soul. So if the sentence makes any sense, it would have to read, the soul is my captain. That makes sense. But to say, I am the captain of my soul means the execution of this soul. It means exactly that it can't grow. It means exactly that I, with my will, my purpose, my aim, my plan, my master plan, my science, that I plan my soul and get birth control. That's what we have today. This is a fantastic sentence. When you begin to think of it, you don't wonder why people are today all crazy and lunatics. I am the captain of my soul. Condemns the man not only to loneliness and isolation, but it condemns him even to supervise his only going point, his soul, from the point of his mind, of his mastermind, of his probably the last book by Mr. Freud, tells him how to treat your soul. That's what it does. Freud is the of course the incarnation of this deviltry. Telling you how to treat your soul instead of allowing your soul to tell you off. Who is master in the house? The devil of your mind or the soul? Now, gentlemen, you have to decide this. Today it is decided in this country in favor of commonplace psychology, commonplace science, commonplace methods of mathematics. You actually think it would be better if you could be mathematically tested and stated. Mathematics is a human invention. So what about it? My mind can never contain me. I'm more than my mind. Tomorrow I will have a different mind. I have a change of mind. Gentlemen, the decision is whether the mind, which is fixed, shall govern growth, or whether they are not. Now the old Renaissance thinkers, gentlemen, who established laboratories, never said before 1789 that man was the captain of his soul. They left the soul alone. And that's why the hostility with the Catholic Church has only reached its danger point during the last 150 years. From 1789 to 1940, you may say, the two were irreconcilable. Because the scientists said that he needed no soul, that the mind was enough.
to entertain him and to misdirect him. It is enough to entertain you and to misdirect you and to produce atomic bombs and liquor. For this purpose, gentlemen, of play and destruction, the mind is perfectly sufficient. The mind is insufficient for making peace and for begetting children. You can't beget children by the mind, you see, because the mind needs to input it. And you can't beget, what was the other, make peace with the mind, because your mind stands in the way of making peace with any other fellow who is of a different mind. The condition of peace, gentlemen, is that the mind is not sovereign. And the condition of children is that the mind is not sovereign. That's why France doesn't multiply anymore. It's terror. No accident, the country of the South Revolution. Because the French held this wisdom that the mind is God. Liberalism thinks that the mind is God. So from 1789 to 1940, church and science are in this strange contradiction. And now we come perhaps to the closest formula. Why? Because it's after 1789 only is the real story of the Western mind forgotten and repressed. It seems in 1789, for the first time, that the universities only had to serve the natural sciences. It is forgotten that there were 400 years of universities, you see, in which human freedom, the right of resistance, human contradictions, marriage, all this had been developed. The processes which the universities in the Middle Ages had developed had become such commonplace in 1789 that the people thought they could take them for granted. And that the institutions by which these insights have been developed, you see, therefore could now be taken over by the academic. So it's a strange story, gentlemen. The academies are not the same as the universities down to 1789. The very moment the first laboratory appears in the university, and these universities give up to persecute the academicians, and say, no, we will welcome you. The academicians go the whole hog and say, out you go, everything that has been here before in this university. And what was the last thing, gentlemen, which shows that the college is older than the laboratory? Which on this campus is the one institution which has stated and is only there as a derelict? Chapel. What time is it, please?
All right.
Let us have a break here.
Advancing from 15 or party number 50 or 1500 to 1940. When Mr. Einstein wrote this notorious letter about the atomic bomb to Mr. Roosevelt, the sovereignty of the scientists broke down. It was impossible after 1940, and it should be impossible for you, to say that science is without conditions, that natural science stands on its own. It doesn't. There are several conditions, gentlemen, under which natural science has been allowed to advance from 1500 to 1940. And if you discover this, gentlemen, you understand why the enmity between Christianity and natural science is very short-lived. It is a sociological enmity from 1640 to 1789. Perhaps you take this down. There are two enmities between the Christianity and science. Or three, but let's put it three, then we include the Protestants. Three enmities. The first enmity from 1500 to 1640, the Protestants say we must have the way of salvation is pure religion. The scientists say the increase is through the discovery of the world. There is two ideas about progress. Luther says, purge the church. The scientists say, purify your mind in things of the world. New observations, new research. If you read Paracelsus, that's all borne out in my pamphlet very clearly, that Paracelsus was neither a Protestant nor a Catholic, you see, that he was not interested in this environmentalism whatsoever. He was a Christian who wanted to take the next step in the history of the human mind, and that was from theology to natural science. By studying it, no longer disputing about two sources in writing, but by going out into the world and comparing research history. So, gentlemen, from 1500 to 1640, the enmity comes from the Protestants against the scientists. From 1640 to 1789, the Catholics fear the mixing of Protestant and Catholics in matters of research. They fear the social mixing of the two. They don't want to let their sheep lie with the wolves. From 1789 to 1940, the liberal mind of the scientists wants to subjugate the soul. He wants to subjugate the soul. The liberal mind wants to subjugate the soul. I am the captain of my soul. In this moment, the soul is lowered below the mind. There can be no soul, but only a psyche. The expression of this domination of the souls of men by mind is that they cease to be called souls. How are they called today? What's the Greek term? Psyche, you see. Psyche. Psyche is that soul which is no longer real but is dominated by my own mind. That's of course no worth nothing. It's a stomach, so to speak. An unreal soul. Psyche, wherever you meet the word psyche, psychosis, the man who has a psychosis is sick. The man who goes to the psychiatrist is sick. The man who goes to the psychoanalyst is like a dead tooth. His psyche is something that can be analyzed. Gentlemen, anything that can be analyzed cannot grow. Analysis excludes growth. Perhaps you take this down. Analysis excludes growth. You can go to the analyst if you wish to erase, to eradicate your tooth, your stump of a soul that you call psyche. But as long as you are healthy, you can embrace your psychoanalyst. You can love him, or you can run away with him, or you can kill him, or you can kill him. But sadly, gentlemen, as long as you have an ounce of soul left in you, you cannot enter a forever relationship with your psychiatrist or analysis. Because it just means that you have given up yourself, that you are gone. That's why the analysts have to put up with the lovers there, with their patients, because they just found that these people have still temperaments of life in them. And life consists in growth of need and love. And so, as you know, in our time, when I live in the liberal world, it is always, we speak of transparency. In good Anglo-Saxon English, it just means that the magnet or loves the doctor. But it has to be transferred so that it seems something, so to speak, of a scientific nature. Now, we don't know about perfectly unscientific. They are just utterances of the human soul. Analysis, gentlemen, and growth are mutually exclusive, just as much as experiment. Whenever you analyze, you give up growth. You may have to give up growth. Wild growth, the weeds, you see, have to be analyzed. to love. That the condition of psychoanalysis is that the doctor knows that this is tolerable, that this is wrong, that it is good to destroy. It's a surgical operation on the soul for that part of it which isn't so, which is their side, which therefore can come under the scrutiny of the employer. It's very simple, gentlemen. Put analysis and experiment on one side and put role on the other and passions. And then you see what you can do with analysis. You can do with analysis whatever you can do with laboratories. And you can do in laboratories anything that can be experimented with. You cannot analyze the attack of the Japanese on Pearl Harbor. Unfortunately, you have to declare war. That's not an analysis of what they have been doing, but it's an answer. You have to respond, you see, if you wish to be kept alive to such an attack. And the idea that you can analyze an act which goes to the center of your being is just nonsense. Now, gentlemen, once more then, from 1789 to 1940, the liberals believed that they could do with experimental mind, and that the people whom they themselves, the founders of science, the scientists of science, the teachers of science, and the popularizer of science, that all these four groups of people, the founders, the research people in science, the educators, and the popularizers, the writers of bestsellers and books of the month club books, that all four could derive their authority from science exclusively. That if you said doctor of psychology, somebody would buy the book because they would say, any doctor in psychology knows his stuff. In 1940, gentlemen, with the atomic bomb, science split up its conditions. Now, which were these conditions, gentlemen, of which the people in the 19th century, the liberals, didn't want to know? First was the brotherhood of all scholars all over the globe. Number one tenet, the brotherhood of all scholars. Second, the right of all men to benefit by the findings of this brotherhood. Third, that progress in science meant progress in life. That progress in science meant progress in society. And fourth, that the public would sacrifice for science, for truth. That the public, that the general public, would always be willing to make sacrifices for truth. Number one, that the process of scientific research unites all men in a brotherhood of scientists, in a republic of scholars. That all scholars are, wherever they live, are a brotherhood. That's exploded by the atomic bomb. Number two, that all mankind will benefit from every one discovery in science. That if you invent the telephone, you cannot hold it away from anybody, you see. It will become commonplace. All technical, you can put adjectives, all technical inventions down to 1940 have been made accessible to everybody. Everybody in this country has a car. That's the thing that is sure you, this is not understood as a, this is a tremendous tenet of faith. You see, you could have a society in China, if an invention was made, it was reserved for the emperor and the poor. And therefore many of the things were lost again. The same in Greece, by the way. Science in outside the Christian world, gentlemen, has not flourished because the inventor kept his science to himself or his potentate. I'll tell you a sad story from Germany as soon as you can. An American businessman invented a special musical whistle for cars in the beginning of the horn, the blowing the horn. It played a little melody, ta-dee, ta-da, and he went to Germany and thought it was a wonderful thing, and went immediately to the emperor, and was well received, and the emperor paid him a nice sum, and bought it. And my man was very happy, but then he of course went on to try to sell this all to others, and they said nothing to him. It's a monopoly for his majesty. The man, his majesty wants to be known wherever he goes by his horn. Well, was a complete sellout, as you can see. The poor man had sold, you see, for one horn his own invention. If he hadn't gone to the emperor first, he might have sold 100,000. That he, by beginning at the top, he enabled a feudal society in which the emperor has this right and tells the chief of police, you won't admit any whistle that's like mine, you see. He excluded the whole market from this thing. And there he was, never returned. He sold one whistle in all the Now that's anti-free scientific, you see, behavior. Science rests on this. It's a good story because it may show the contours. This attitude of the German emperor clearly violates the tenet of scientific progress. You see, where all technological things based on science are made a technical evidence. You take them for granted, then it's perfectly possible that certain things becomes a reservation of the FBI very soon. Perhaps they say we only can have wiretapping and television, and nobody else can, because we want to be in on everything, but nobody else must. You can imagine such a state of affairs. I'm sure in Russia they have things accessible to the leading group which the masses just never see, by caviar and champagne. So, gentlemen, technological progress assumes a constant spread to everybody of its benefits. Third, the progressive steps are assuredly beneficial to society. Progress is beneficial. And fourth, the support of this progress in the direction of more truth or more facts will always be supported by the people. I've reformulated the four, but it's exactly the same thing. These four laws, you see. This is the minimum tenet of every modern scientist, gentlemen, and it is no longer valid. Progress in science is no longer, no fool can say that it is beneficial to society under all circumstances. Why is genocide beneficial? It is. It's ambiguous, you see. You can't tell. Progress, scientific progress, gentlemen, is void of any direction. It can be beneficial and it can be non-beneficial. We don't know. Certainly, I don't say it is wrong to say that it is identified. We identified as beneficial. It isn't. It is just what it is. It's change, but never can we say whether it's changed for the better. We don't know. All depends on the human beings who handle it, whether it's for the better. Number two. It is not true that the solidarity between scholars is gone. It is not true that the solidarity between the scholars is growing. Quite the contrary, they are split up. Third, it is not sure that everyone will be allowed to participate. You can have monopolies, like the atomic bomb. Poor nations will be our excluded from any access to the EU. And number four, the masses don't like the EU. Up and down, neither the rich or the poor. Wherever you get any crowd or mob, you cannot assume that they are interested in the truth. They aren't. They will not make sacrifices for the truth. They will far prefer their legends, and their myths, and their fairy tales. They won't. I mean, you can't tell the truth about the war between the states in South Carolina to the states. Last man who tried committed suicide. So, gentlemen, the four tenets, why could they be believed by the academics, gentlemen? Because the universities existed, the universities developed these four tenets. That is, the four tenets on which natural science has been based were all created between 1100 and 1500. To give you a little example, gentlemen, how this was done, it was done in chapel. The chapel of the Middle Ages, gentlemen, out of which every scholar in the Middle Ages came, has, of course, these four tenets. First, in chapel, you believe in the solidarity of the human race. Second, you believe that in God's government in the Christian era, progress is possible. Jesus left the word that the Spirit would show better things to his disciples, better than he even could tell them. And so progress is based on this unity of our era. Third, peace is the destiny of men. Therefore, the third tenet, the progress will be beneficial. In chapel, that is, makes sense. And fourth, the clergy and the laity are identical in their purposes. The scientist today, you see, if he is paid well by the government, may exclude the Russians from the atomic bomb. A clergyman of the Universal Church can never think of himself as any other relation as to the laity, to the people, because he comes from the people and belongs to the people, and he doesn't belong to the state, certainly. He doesn't belong to the American government. Gentlemen, in chapel, the four tenets all make clear sense. They don't make sense in the laboratory. They have made sense for the last 400 years because every scientist, gentlemen, takes this down. Every scientist got these four tenets because he had to rival with the church. The rivalry of science with Christianity, with the church, made the scientists behave. They all tried to be as good as gold, so to speak. They tried to be as good as a Christian. What did a scientist say? I can be a Christian without being a member of the church. But the idea was always, you see, that the church was didn't do a contribute anything to being good or to being progressive. So let's be as good as a Christian. You know all these people, whom perhaps you are one of them yourself, who used to say, well, how can the church not doing its part and it's obsolete and Christianity is a good thing, but the church testifies against Christianity. If the Christians were only better, I could believe in Christianity, you see. That's a typical scientific idea. It always presupposes, gentlemen, that the scientist understands Christianity without belonging to it and appreciates it and in his own life realizes it. So, gentlemen, the modern scientist for the last 500 years competed with the church. He competed with the church. He tried to be as good as them in his truthfulness, in his brotherhood with all people all over the globe, in his willingness to let everybody benefit from his inventions. You see? and in his fervent service for the progress of mankind. All these ten planets, gentlemen, are pre-natural, and they are supernatural, and they come from chapel. All medieval thinkers, gentlemen, were educated in chapel, and all college students were, down to 1921, I think, in this college. That had a tremendous effect, of course. Because in chapel you observe these four items, gentlemen. That all men are one in one spirit. That the specialist has to serve the people, the clergyman, the laity, the expert, is all. That knowledge is service. Knowledge is not power. Now today, unfortunately, as you know, that's turning. Knowledge is power. The Marxians say so, and the government says so, and it buys these scientists as brain power, as brain trust. Without chapel, gentlemen, science belongs to the pig part. Or how do you say it? Science without the prerequisite that the scientist must be a good Christian in his heart is impossible. Because science is based on the assumption that its direction is beneficial to the whole of mankind, to the whole of human history, to the whole of all strata of society, and that man, who is not a scientist, is eager to support it, the masses, you see. That they have the light of reason, even if they don't have it themselves, in high regard. That they respect it. So you have four conditions there, you see, gentlemen. The four conditions of chapel are, first, the mankind is one. Second, history is one. Third, the direction of history is the same for the men in power and the people led by them, the directed people. And that the masses will respect the sacrifices made for them, you see. And that the people who lead will respect the masses. That's a four very difficult human principles, gentlemen, of which you can completely lose sight if you are uneducated and trained. Then you get Mr. Hitler's doctors who experiment with inmates in concentration camps, because this is very interesting to find out how human beings behave. What does this mean? They had no solidarity for the whole of mankind. See the difference? This happens everywhere today. You get it with euthanasia. The society today doesn't want to be bothered with old people or suffering people, so why don't not do away with them? They finally agree themselves. It's an impatience to be with human beings if they live too long or they live in an unhealthy condition, for example. Gentlemen, today you have to decide, this is a tremendously exciting moment, whether you recognize the in mutual dependency of the chapel and the laboratory, or whether you don't, that will signify your stand in the new era. The new parties, gentlemen, therefore, of the future are the ones who isolate the laboratory. Whether you call yourself a capitalist or a communist or a scientist or a Bolshevik, gentlemen, makes no difference. Mr. Hawking is just as much a Bolshevik in this respect as a Bolshevik is Mr. Hawking. Mr. Hawking believes that the mind is the captain of the soul, for example. He is a good Hegelian. Hegel is the philosopher of this domination of the mind over the human soul. And I come from a country, my dear friends, where I had to fight hard to rid myself of this prejudice. I know what I'm talking about because Hegel is the philosopher of this very sentence. And Marx is, as you know, is a disciple of this man. And they both teach that man is the captain of his soul. So, gentlemen, the chapel develops four qualities. And how what time is it? Has the same 1 minute left? I'd like to give you a little example how simple the progress of the human race is. In 1100, a book was written which may give you an insight into what all these schoolmen of the Middle Ages went through before they began to concord the law or theology. It was a handbook for the father confessor in church, a manual for the confessions. And it's a very great book and was read all over Europe in the Middle Ages. It just called On True and False Penitence. That's the title. The title of this manual is perhaps, you don't know the author. It was in existence by 1100. Now to give you an example of how the solidarity of the human race had to be created, I'll quote you one item there. It says that in the world, the judges the criminal according to the law of the city, of the land, if there's murder, commits murder. But he says in church, in chapel, when you hear a man's confession, the first thing the judge has to say to himself is, I did this, committed this sin myself. That is, the first condition for a father confessor, gentlemen, is the opposite from a secular judge. The first attitude must be, I committed this sin myself. Judge and sinner are identical. Now, you always think of the solidarity of the human race, too far-fetched, Negro and white and Chinese and American. That's when you think of the brotherhood of men. Gentlemen, the first solidarity of the human race consists about the people, between people who judge each other. If you say that's a wicked deed of somebody else, you see, you break your solidarity. The first attempt must be, would I tell it to you? In this moment you create the real solidarity of the human race. I'll put it this down, gentlemen. Chapel doesn't look for the solidarity of the human race between distant people in space, in far distant spaces. The real problem is, gentlemen, the solidarity of the human race with your neighbor. Which is much more difficult to achieve, as you know. Let's go to an apartment out in New York and study the degree of solidarity between tenants on the same floor there. Every one of these people is much nicer to the next Chinaman in Shanghai than he is to his neighbor there. Because he doesn't know of his neighbor there. And he reads the papers about the crime in Shanghai. There's no greater stranger today, as you well know, than neighbors in an apartment house. In these big tenements, sorry. Nobody is a man more alone than in the big city, obviously. He has much more solidarity with the Zulu ego in South Africa. He can send him a passage, but he can't. Bring up to me by the apartment and say, hello, buddy. And he says, the solidarity of the human race, gentlemen, is today is completely lost between neighbors. The judge of the Middle Ages was pulled down to the level of the judge every day in the educational process of chapel. You take this for granted. But you must now know that before 1100, no judge could not be dynamo, no judge Cardozo, or no judge to learn a man has any use for saying, I will defend this myself. He judged the criminal as somebody different. That was the fatal position. It still was in force at that time. In church, yes, you mix, but not in the world. But from 1100 on, every man who went to study theology and law, it was driven in day after day that the judge and the judge were the same man. You see the tremendous creative force in this?
is that every father confessor in the Western world said in his, since the day in his confessional, with a deep feeling, there is no violation of the Ten Commandments which I couldn't have committed myself. You see? Therefore, that's why you can confess your sins to this one. Obviously. I think you are good heirs of this tradition, gentlemen. In your heart of hearts, you have this solidarity. Any American boy has this openness that he knows the other fellow is dressed in the same boat. But please treasure it and know whence it comes. It doesn't come from science, you see. But it comes from a much simpler attitude of the unity of the human race, that sins we have all in common, our deficiencies, and that nobody who comes to you with a crime can be told by you that you wouldn't have done it. There's nothing so black, because also there's nothing so white, which is not in every one of us. Isn't that true? So, gentlemen, I want to give you this example to insist that chapel is at the root of modern science. There is no laboratory which we can permit without chapel, because otherwise you get the concentration camp. You get the experimentation with human life. You get wars of aggression. You get the uprooting of whole populations. You get the killing of all the kulaks, just because they have some land. You see, they have to give way to modern poetry. You get the censorship of Mr. Chester Comet or any other composer if he doesn't follow the party line. Growth is not admitted. You see? They are all captains of men's souls, these Portuguese. Any Platonist, any philosopher, king. Wherever you hear men say, let the philosopher be king, run away. Because when the philosopher is king, the mind rules the soul. And the mind is then master of God. And the nurse can push back the child into the body of the mother and reverse the process of living life, of course. Because the mind has made the rule and regulation that the doctor should be present. So, reality cannot be necessary, because the mind is not satisfied, not according to science. Thank you.